Kater longed to know what went on behind those blind windows. Morale had not been able to find out, and neither had he. But he would be satisfied just to cause damage. The Tlaloxu, for all their bloody repressions, had grown lax over 16 years. Their security measures were laughable, and he would now show them the error of their ways. This strike had to be significant enough to make them reel, because the next attempt would not be so easy. Staring after the rail car, Kater suppressed a smile of anticipation. Behind him, workers prepped a new empty pallet car with more supplies. He glanced up at the grotto ceiling, at the gossamer buildings protruding like inverted islands through the projected sky. Timing was crucial. All four bombs had to go off close together. This would be as much a psychological victory as a material one. The Tlaloxu invaders must come to the conclusion that a large and coordinated resistance movement was responsible for these attacks, that the rebels had a widespread membership and an organized plan. They must never guess that there are only two of us. In the wake of an outrageous success, others might begin their own struggles. If enough people took action, it would make the large-scale rebellion a self-fulfilling prophecy. He drew a deep breath and turned back to the other waiting crates. He dared not show any out-of-the-ordinary behavior. Overhead, surveillance pods moved about constantly, lights blinking, trans-eye cameras imaging every movement. He did not glance at his chronometer, but he knew the time was close. When the first explosion shuddered through the cavern floor deep underground, the dull-brained workers paused in their tasks and looked at each other in confusion. Kater knew that the detonation at the disposal pits should have been sufficient to collapse the rooms, to twist and destroy the conveyor belts. Perhaps the rubble would even seal the tops of the deep magma shafts. Before anyone could notice the smug expression on his face, the stalactite buildings in the ceiling exploded. Inside his sensor-shielded bolt hole within the administrative levels, a cluster of explosive wafers tore out entire levels of the bureaucratic complex. One wing of the Grand Palais was wrecked, left hanging by long girders and broken reinforced strands. Debris rained into the center of the cavern, and workers fled in panic. A bright light and swirling cloud of rock powder spread from the torn ceiling chambers. Blaring alarms echoed against the stone walls like thunder. He hadn't heard such a racket since the initial suboid uprising years ago. Everything was working perfectly. In feigned horror, he backed away with the rest of the Ixion laborers, standing among them for implied protection, lost in the crowd. He smelled the dust of building materials and the stench of fear around him. He heard a distant explosion from the direction of the building where Morale worked, and knew she was clever enough to have gotten away before setting it off. Then, at last, precisely as he had hoped, the loaded pallet car arrived inside the loading dock of the secret research pavilion. The final set of explosive wafers erupted in streaks of fire and black clouds of smoke. The sounds of the detonation rang out like a space battle within the thick walls. Fires began to spread. Armed Sardaukar troops rushed about like heat-maddened beetles, trying to find the source of the concerted attack. They fired at the sky ceiling just to express their anger. Alarms rattled the walls. Over the PA system, Tlaloxu masters screamed incomprehensible orders in their private language, while the work crews muttered in subdued fear. But even in the chaos, Kater recognized a strange look on some of the Ixion faces. A sort of satisfaction. A sense of wonder that such a victory could have occurred. They had long ago lost their heart for fighting. Now, perhaps, they could regain it. At last, Kater thought as he blinked in dull-eyed shock, trying to cover his smile. He squared his shoulders, but quickly let them sag as he sought to recapture the demeanor of a defeated and cooperative prisoner. At last, a true blow had been struck against the invaders. There exists no way of exchanging information without making judgments. Bene Gesserit Axiom. From the balcony of her private apartment, Jessica observed her frumpy, apple-cheeked lady-in-waiting in the practice yard near the West Guardhouse. She watched as the breathless woman chattered with Thufir Hawat, using too many hand gestures as she spoke. Both of them glanced up at her window. "Does the Mentat think I am stupid?" In the month that Jessica had lived on Caladan, her every need had been met with cold precision, as a respected guest, but no more. Thufir Hawat had personally seen to her comforts, placing her in the former apartments of the Lady Helena Atreides. After being sealed for so many years, the chambers had needed to be aired out. But the fine furniture, the pool bath and sunroom, the complete wardrobe, were all more than she required. A Bene Gesserit needed very little in the way of comfort and luxury. The Mentat had also arranged for Jessica's busybody lady-in-waiting, who flitted around her like a moth, finding little tasks that kept her close to Jessica at all times. Obviously one of Hawat's spies. Abruptly, Jessica had dismissed the woman from service that very morning, giving her no reason. Now she sat back to await the repercussions. Would the Master of Assassins come himself, or would he send a representative? Would he even understand her intended message? "Don't underestimate me, Thufir Hawat." From the balcony she saw him break from his discussion with the disgraced woman. Moving with confidence and strength, he strode away from the West Guardhouse toward the castle proper. A strange man, that Mentat. While still at the mother school, Jessica had memorized Hawat's background. How he'd spent half his life at a Mentat training center, first as a student and later as a philosopher and theoretical tactician, before being purchased for the newly titled Duke Paulus Atreides, Leto's father. Using her Bene Gesserit powers of observation, Jessica studied the leathery, confident man. Hawat wasn't like other graduates of the Mentat schools, the introverted types who shied away from personal contact. Instead, the deadly man was aggressive and crafty, with a fanatic loyalty to House Atreides. In some ways, his deadly nature resembled that of the Tleilaxu-twisted Peter de Vries. But Hawat was the ethical opposite of the Harkonnen Mentat. It was all very curious. Similarly, she had noticed the old Master of Assassins scrutinizing her through his Mentat logic filter, processing bits of data about her, and arriving at unsubstantiated conclusions. Hawat could be very dangerous indeed. They all wanted to know why she was here, why the Bene Gesserit had chosen to send her, and what she meant to do. Jessica heard a heavy-knuckled rap on the door, and answered it herself. "Now we shall see what he has to say. Enough games." Hawat's lips were moist with sappho juice, and the deep-set brown eyes showed concern and agitation. "Please explain why you were dissatisfied with the servant I chose for you, my lady." Jessica wore a lavender sous satin single suit, which showed off the curves of her slender body. Her makeup was minimal, only a bit of lavender around the eyes and lip tint to match. Her expression had no softness at all. "Given your legendary prowess, I thought you would be a man of greater subtlety, Thufir Hawat. If you are going to spy on me, choose someone a little more competent in the wiles of espionage." The bold comment surprised him, and he looked at the young woman with heightened respect. "I am in charge of the Duke's security, my lady, tending to his personal safety. I must take whatever actions I feel are required." Jessica closed the door, and they stood in the entry, close enough for a killing blow by either of them. "Mentat, what do you know of the Bene Gesserit?" A slight smile etched his leathery face. "Only what the sisterhood permits outsiders to know." With raised voice, she snapped, "When the Reverend Mothers brought me here, Leto became my sworn master as well. Do you think I pose a danger to him, that the sisterhood would take direct action against a Duke of the Landsraad? In the history of the Imperium, are you aware of a single instance in which such a thing has happened? It would be suicide for the Bene Gesserit." She flared her nostrils. "Think, Mentat. What is your projection?" After a heavy moment, Hawat said, "I am unaware of any such instance, my lady." "And yet you stationed that clumsy wench to keep me under surveillance. Why do you fear me? What do you suspect?" She stopped herself from using voice, which Hawat would never forgive. Instead, she added a quieter threat. "I caution you. Do not attempt to lie to me. There, let him think I am a truth-sayer." "I apologize for the indiscretion, my lady. Perhaps I am a bit overzealous in protecting my duke." This is a strong young woman, Hawat thought. The duke could do much worse. "I admire your devotion to him." Jessica noticed that his eyes had grown softer, but without evidence of fear, merely a bit more respect. "I have been here only a short time, while you have served 3 generations of Atreides. You bear a scar on your leg from a Seleucid bull, from one of the old duke's early encounters, do you not? It is not easy for you to accommodate something new." She took the faintest step away from him, letting a trickle of regret enter her voice. "So far, your duke has treated me more like a distant relative, but I hope he will not find me displeasing in the future." "He does not find you displeasing at all, my lady. But he has already chosen Caelia Vernius as a partner. She is the mother of his son." It had not taken Jessica long to learn that there were fractures in the relationship. "Come now, Mentat. She is not his bound concubine, and not his wife. Either way, he has given the boy no birthright. What message are we to derive from that?" Hawat stood rigid, as if offended. Leto's father taught him to use marriage only to gain political advantage for House Atreides. He has many prospects in the Landsraad. He has not yet calculated the best match, though he is considering.
Let him consider, then.
Jessica signaled that the conversation was over. She waited for him to turn. And then she added,
"Henceforth, Thufir Hawat, I prefer to choose my own ladies-in-waiting."
"As you wish." After the Mentat had departed, Jessica assessed her situation, thinking of long-term plans rather than her mission for the sisterhood. Her beauty could be enhanced by Bene Gesserit seduction techniques. But Leto was proud and individualistic. The Duke might guess her intentions and would resent being manipulated. Even so, Jessica had a job to do. In fleeting moments, she had noticed him looking at her with guilt in his eyes, particularly after fights with Caelia. Whenever Jessica tried to take advantage of those moments, though, he quickly grew cold and pulled away. Living in the Lady Helena's former quarters did not help either. Leto was reluctant to go there. Following the death of Paulus Atreides, the enmity between Leto and his mother had been extreme, and Helena had gone to rest and meditate in a remote religious retreat. To Jessica, it smacked of banishment, but she had found no clear reasons in the Atreides' records. Being placed in these rooms could act as an emotional barrier between them. Leto Atreides was certainly dashing and handsome, and Jessica would have no trouble accepting his company. In fact, she wanted to be with him. She chided herself whenever such feelings came over her,
as they did too frequently. She could not allow emotions to sway her. The Bene Gesserit had no use for love. "I have a job to do," she reminded herself. Jessica would bide her time and wait for just the right moment. Infinity attracts us like a floodlight in the night, blinding us to the excesses it can inflict upon the finite. Meditations from Bifrost Erie, Buddhist-Islamic text. 4 months after the avalanche disaster, Abelard Harkonnen and his wife embarked on a well-publicized visit to the recovering mountain city. The Bifrost Erie tragedy had struck to the heart of Lankavile and drawn the populace together. Steadfast companions, he and Emmy had shown their combined strength. For years now, Abelard had preferred to be a behind-the-scenes ruler, not even claiming the specific title that was his due. He wanted the people of Lankavile to govern themselves, to help each other according to their hearts. He saw the various villagers, hunters, and fishermen as a great extended family, all with common interests. Then, speaking with quiet confidence, Emmy convinced her husband that a public pilgrimage as acting planetary governor would draw attention to the plight of the mountain stronghold. The burgomaster, Onir Rautha Rabban, would welcome them. Abelard and Emmy rode in a formal transport flanked by servants and retainers, many of whom had never been far from the whaling villages. The three ornithopters passed slowly inland over glaciers and snow-covered mountains, toward the line of crags in which the monastery city nestled. With the sun sparkling off snow and ice crystals from protruding mountaintops, the world appeared pristine and peaceful. Ever an optimist, Abelard hoped the Bifrost inhabitants could now look forward to an even stronger future. He had written a speech that imparted basically the same message. Though he had little experience addressing large crowds, Abelard looked forward to delivering this communication. He'd already practiced twice in front of Emmy. On a plateau in front of the sheer cliffs of Bifrost Erie, the governor's procession landed, and Abelard and his entourage disembarked. Emmy walked at her husband's side, looking regal in a heavy blue cape. He took her arm. The construction teams had made amazing progress. They had sliced away the intruding fan of snow and excavated the buried buildings. Because most of the wonderful architecture had been destroyed or defaced, the broken buildings were now covered with a webwork of scaffolding. Skilled stonemasons worked round the clock to add block upon block, rebuilding and glorifying the retreat. Bifrost Erie would never be the same. But perhaps it could be even better than before, like a phoenix rising from the snowfield. Stocky Onir Rautha Rabban came out to meet them, dressed in gilded robes lined with sable whale fur. Emmy's father had shaved off his voluminous gray beard after the disaster. Whenever he looked in a reflecting glass, he wanted to be reminded of how much his mountain city had lost. This time his broad, squarish face seemed content, lit with a fire that had not been present the last time they'd been together. With the arrival of their planetary governor, workers climbed down from scaffoldings and picked their way along packed snowfield paths into the large square. When completed, the towering buildings would look down upon the square like gods from on high. Even incomplete, the soaring stonework remained impressive. The weather had cooperated since the avalanche, but in another month or two, the hard snap of winter would force them to cease their efforts and huddle within the stone buildings for half a year. Bifrost Erie would not be finished this season. With the magnitude of construction work, perhaps it would never be complete. But the people would continue to build, enhancing their prayer in stone to the skies of Lankavile. When the crowds had gathered, Abelard raised his hands to speak, rehearsing again in his mind. Then all the words drained from his mind to be replaced with nervousness. Looking like a queen beside him, Emmy reached out to touch his arm, giving her support. Then she whispered his opening lines, helping him remember what he needed to say. "My friends," he said loudly, grinning with embarrassment. "Buddhist-Islamic teachings encourage charity, hard work, and assistance to those in need. There can be no better example of heartfelt cooperation than what you volunteers are doing now to rebuild." The gathered people began to murmur, gesturing toward the sky and whispering among themselves. Abelard hesitated again, turning to look over his shoulder. Just then Emmy cried out. A formation of black ships appeared in the azure sky, swooping toward the mountains, attack craft that bore the griffin of House Harkonnen. Abelard's brows knitted, more in puzzlement than alarm. He looked over at his wife. "What does this mean, Emmy? I did not call for any ships." But she had no better idea than he did. 7 fighters roared low, engines cracking through the air with sonic booms. Abelard felt a flash of annoyance, afraid the thunderous sound would provoke fresh avalanches, until the ship's gun ports opened. The people of the mountain stronghold began milling back and forth in confusion, shouting. Some ran, searching for shelter. Abelard could not understand what he was seeing. 3 of the sleek craft slowed to a hover over the square where the villagers were gathered. Laser guns extended, targeted. Abelard waved his hands, trying to get the pilot's attention. "What are you doing? There must be some mistake." Emmy pushed him away from the speaking podium where he was a prime target.
"There's no mistake."
The villagers scrambled for cover as the vessel settled down to land in the square. Abelard was convinced the pilots would have landed right on top of the crowd if the spectators had not moved fast enough. "Stay here," he said to Emmy, as he strode toward the trio of landed ships to demand answers. The 4 remaining vessels circled in the air and came back. With a buzzing crackle of static, hot laser gun beams lanced out to slice scaffolding from the stone buildings like a fisherman gutting his catch. "Stop!" Abelard shouted to the skies, clenching his fists. But none of the military men could hear him. These were Harkonnen troops, loyal to his own family. But they were attacking his people, the citizens of Lankavile. "Stop!" he repeated, reeling backward from the shockwaves. Emmy grabbed him and pulled him aside as one of the ships swooped low, creating a sharp, hot wind with its passage. More laser gun fire lanced out, this time targeting the milling mass of people. The blasts slew dozens in a single sweep. Chunks of ice toppled from the glaciers, crystalline blue-white blocks that fell in a flash of steam as they were cauterized from the main mass. Half-completed buildings were crushed under the onslaught as laser gun beams chopped them to bits. The 4 attack craft came around a third time, while the other vessels powered down and stabilized on the ground. Their doors hissed open, and Harkonnen troops boiled out, wearing dark blue commando assault uniforms, insulated against the cold.
"I am Abelard Harkonnen, and I order you to stop."
After quick glances in his direction, the soldiers ignored him. Then Glossu Raban stepped out of the craft. Weapons bristled from his belt, and military insignia covered his shoulders and breast. An iridescent black helmet made him look like a gladiator in an ancient coliseum. Recognizing his grandson, Onir Rautha Raban raced forward, his hands clasped in front of him, beseeching. His face was splotched with anger and horror.
"Please stop! Glossu Raban, why are you doing this?"
At the other side of the square, the ground troops withdrew laser rifles and opened fire on screaming villagers, who had no place to go. Before the old burgomaster could reach Raban on the boarding ramp, soldiers grabbed him and dragged him away. His face stormy, Abelard marched toward Raban. Harkonnen troops moved to block his way, but he snapped, "Let me pass." Raban looked over at him with cold, metal eyes.
His thick lips were drawn into a satisfied line above his blocky chin.
Father, your people must learn that there are worse things than natural disasters.
He raised his chin a notch.
If they find excuses to avoid paying their tithes, they will face an unnatural disaster. Me! Call them off!
Abelard raised his voice even as he felt completely impotent.
I am governor here, and these are my people.
Rabban looked at him in disgust.
And they need an example to understand the kind of behavior that's expected of them. It's not a complicated issue, but obviously you don't provide the proper inspiration.
Arcanan soldiers dragged the struggling Onir Rabban toward an abrupt cliff edge. Emmy saw what they meant to do and screamed.
Abelard whirled to see that they had brought his father-in-law to the sheer ice-frosted precipice.
The chasm below ended only in a soup of clouds.
You can't do that, Abelard said, aghast. That man is the lawful leader of this village. He's your own grandfather.
Smiling, Rabban whispered the words with no emotion, no sense of command.
Oh, wait. Stop.
There was no chance the troops could hear him. They already had their orders. The Harkonnen guards grabbed the burgomaster by both arms and held him like a loose sack of cargo at the brink.
Emmy's father cried out, his arms and legs flailing.
He looked over at Abelard, his face filled with disbelief and horror. Their eyes met.
Oh, dear me, please no, Rabban whispered again, with a grin curving his lips.
Then the soldiers shoved the old man over, and he disappeared into the void.
Too late,
Rabban said with a shrug. Emmy fell to her knees, retching.
Abelard, who couldn't decide whether to comfort her or rush forward to strike his son, remained paralyzed.
With a clap of his meaty hands, Rabban called out,
Enough! Fall in!
Loud signals came from the landed battleships. With military precision, the Harkonnen troops marched back to their ships in perfect ranks. They left wailing survivors who scurried over to the bodies, searching for companions, loved ones, anyone who might need medical attention. On the ramp of the flagship, Rabban studied his father.
Be thankful I was willing to do your dirty work. You've used too light a touch on these people, and they've grown lazy.
The four flying vessels completed one more attack run, which devastated another building, causing it to collapse in a rumble of rock dust. Then they flew off, regrouping in a formation in the sky.
If you force my hand again, I'll have to show a little more muscle. All in your name, of course.
Rabban turned about and strode back into his command ship. Appalled and disoriented, Abelard stared in utter horror at the obliteration, the fires, the awful cauterized bodies. He heard a mounting scream like a song of mourning, and realized it came from his own throat. Emmy had staggered over to the cliff edge and stood sobbing as she stared down into the bottomless clouds where her father had disappeared. The last Harkonnen ships lifted into the sky on suspensors, leaving scorch marks on the clearing in front of the now devastated mountain city. Abelard sank to his knees in utter despair, his mind filled with a roaring hum of disbelief and a bright agony dominated by the smug expression of Glossu Rabban.
How could I have ever sired such a monster?
He knew he would never find an answer to that question. Love is the highest achievement to which any human may aspire. It is an emotion that encompasses the full depth of heart, mind, and soul. Zen Sunni Wisdom from The Wandering. Leet Kynes and Warwick spent an evening together near Splintered Rock in Haga Basin. They had raided another one of the old botanical testing stations for usable equipment, taking inventory of a few tools and records the desert had preserved for centuries.
For 2 years following their return from the South Polar regions, the young men had accompanied Pardet Kynes from Siech to Siech, checking the progress of old and new plantings. The planetologist maintained a secret greenhouse cave at Plaster Basin, a captive Eden to demonstrate what Dune could become. Water from catch traps and wind stills irrigated the shrubs and flowers. Many freemen had received samples grown in the Plaster Basin demonstration project. They took sweet pieces of the fruit as a holy communion, closing their eyes and breathing deeply, relishing the taste. All of this Pardet Kynes had promised, and all of this he had given them. He was proud that his visions were becoming reality. He was also proud of his son. "One day you will be Imperial Planetologist here, Leet," he said, nodding solemnly. Though he spoke with passion about awakening the desert, bringing in grasses and biodiversity for a self-sustaining ecosystem, Kynes could not teach any subject in an orderly or structured fashion. Warwick hung on every word he said, but the man often began with one topic, then rambled on to other topics at his whim. "We are all part of a grand tapestry, and we each must follow our own threads," Pardet Kynes said, more pleased with his own words than he should have been. Oftentimes he would recount the stories of his days on Seleucus Secundus, how he had studied a wilderness no one else had bothered with. The planetologist had spent years on Beletejuice, seeing how the hardy plant life flourished despite the dim sunlight and acidic soil. There had also been journeys to Harmonthep, Third Delta Kaizing, Gamont, and Porotrin, and the dazzling court on Kytane, where Emperor Elrud IX had given him this assignment on Arrakis. Now, as Leet and Warwick made their way from Splintered Rock, a heavy wind picked up, a Hainali, or man-pusher. Bending into the stinging gusts, Leet pointed to the lee of a rock outcropping. "Let us set up our shelter there." His dark hair bound in a shoulder-length ponytail, Warwick trudged forward, head lowered, already removing his Fremkit pack. Working together, they soon had a protected, camouflaged camp and hunkered down to talk far into the night. In 2 years, the young men had told no one about Dominic Vernius and his smuggler base. They had given their word to the man, and kept it a secret between themselves. They were both 18 and expected to marry soon. But Leet, dizzy with the hormones of his age, could not choose. He found himself more and more attracted to Farula, the willowy, large-eyed, but tempestuous daughter of Hainar, the Naib of Redwall Siech. Farula was trained in the lore of the herbalist, and would, one day, be a well-respected healer. Unfortunately for him, Warwick desired Farula as well, and Leet knew that his blood brother was more likely to gather the courage to ask the Naib's daughter before he could make his own clumsy move. The two friends fell asleep, listening to the whispering fingernails of sand blown against their tent. The following dawn, when they climbed out, knocking powdery dust from the sphincter opening of the tent, Leet stared across the expanse of Haga Basin. Warwick blinked in the bright light. "Kowahad!" The night windstorm had blown the dirt clear of a broad white playa, the salty remnants of an ancient, dried sea. Scoured clean, the lake bed wavered in the rising heat of the day. "A gypsum plain! A rare sight," Leet said. Then added in a mutter, "My father would probably run down and do tests." Warwick spoke in a low, awed voice. "It is said that he who sees beyond the White Lands can make a wish, and it is sure to be granted." He fell silent and moved his lips, expressing his deepest, most private desires. Not to be outdone, Leet uttered his own fervent thoughts in a rush. He turned to his friend and announced, "I wish that Farula would be my wife." Warwick gave him a bemused smile. Bad luck, my blood brother. I wished for the same thing. With a laugh, he clapped Leet on the shoulder. It seems that not all wishes can come true. At dusk, the two met Pardet Kynes as he arrived at Sign Rock Seach. The Seach elders solemnly went through a greeting ceremony, pleased with what they had accomplished. Kynes accepted their welcome with brusque good grace, offhandedly foregoing many of the formal responses in his eagerness to inspect everything himself. The planetologist went to inspect their plantings under bright glow globes that simulated sunlight within crannies of rock. The sand had been fertilized with chemicals and human feces to create a rich soil. The people of Sign Rock grew mesquite, sage, rabbit bush, even a few accordion-trunked saguaros, surrounded by scrubby grasses. Groups of robed women went from plant to plant, as if in a religious ceremony, adding cupfuls of water so the plants could thrive. The stone walls of Sign Rock's blocked-off canyon retained a bit of moisture every morning. Dew precipitators along the top of the canyon recaptured lost water vapor and returned it to the plants. In the evening, Kynes walked from planting to planting, bending over to study leaves and stems. He'd already forgotten that his son and Warwick had come to meet him. His warrior escort, Amun and Turok, stood guard, willing to give their lives should anything threaten their Oma. Leet noticed his father's intense concentration and wondered if the man even realized the sheer loyalty he inspired among these people. At the mouth of the narrow canyon, where a few boulders and rocks provided the only barrier against open desert, Freeman children had tethered bright glow globes that shone onto the sand. Each child carried a bent metal rod extracted from a Carthag refuse dump. Enjoying the private stillness of the gathering night, Leet and Warwick squatted on a rock to watch the children. Warwick sniffed and looked behind them toward the artificial sunlight on the bushes and cacti. The little makers are drawn to the moisture like iron filings to a magnet. Leet had seen the activity before, had done it himself as a boy, but was still fascinated to see the young ones poking about to capture sand trout. They have easy pickings. One of the young girls bent to let a small drop of saliva fall onto the end of her metal staff. Then she extended the rod over the sands. The miniature tethered glow globes cast deep shadows on the uneven ground. Creatures stirred under the surface, rising out of the dust. The sand trout were shapeless, fleshy creatures, soft and flexible. Their bodies were pliable when alive, yet they turned hard and leathery when dead. Many little makers were found strewn about the site of a spice blow, killed in the explosion. Many more burrowed to capture the released water, sealing it away to protect Shai Hulud. One of the sand trout extended a pseudopod toward the glistening tip of the rod. When it touched the girl's saliva, the Freeman child turned the metal stick, as if to capture a self-moving flow of taffy. She raised her rod, taking the sand trout out of the ground, and twirled it to keep the amorphous little maker suspended in the air. The other children giggled. A second child caught another sand trout, and both hurried back to the rocks, where they played with their prizes. They could poke and tug the soft flesh, teasing out a few droplets of sweet syrup, a special treat that Leet himself had loved in his youth. Though tempted to try his own hand at the game, Leet reminded himself that he was an adult now, a full member of the tribe. He was the son of Oma Kynes. The other freemen would frown to see him engage in frivolous play. Warwick sat on the rock beside him, wrapped in his thoughts, watching the children and thinking of a future family of his own. He looked up into the purpling sky. "It is said that storm season is the time for love-making." He wrinkled his brow, then placed his narrow chin in his hands, deep in concentration. He had begun to grow a thin beard. Leet smiled. He still kept his own face clean-shaven. "It is time for both of us to choose a mate, Warwick." They held Farula in their thoughts, and the Naib's daughter led them on, feigning aloofness while enjoying their attentions. Leet and Warwick brought her special treasures from the desert whenever they could. "Perhaps we should make our selection the Freeman way." Warwick withdrew from his belt a pair of polished bone slivers as long as knives. "Shall we throw tally sticks to see who may court Farula?" Leet had his own pair of the gambling markers. He and his friend had spent many camp nights challenging each other. Tally sticks were slender carvings with a scale of random numbers etched along the sides, high numbers mixed with low ones. The freeman threw bone tallies into the sand, then read off the number of the depth. Whoever achieved the highest score won. It required finesse as well as plain luck. "If we played tally sticks, I would beat you, of course," Leet said offhandedly to Warwick. "I doubt that." "In any event, Farula would never abide by the throw of the bones." Leet sat back against the cool rock wall. "Perhaps it is time for the Ahal ceremony, where a woman chooses her mate." "Do you think Farula would choose me?" Warwick said wistfully. "Of course not. In most things I trust your judgment, my friend, but not in this." "Perhaps I shall ask her myself when I return," Leet said. "She couldn't want a better husband than me." Warwick laughed. "In most challenges you are a brave man, Leet Kynes, but when facing a beautiful woman, you are a shameful coward." Leet drew a deep, indignant breath. "I have composed a love poem for her. I mean to write it down on spice paper and leave it in her chamber." "Oh?" Warwick teased. "And would you have the nerve to sign it with your own name? What is this beautiful poem you've written?" Leet closed his eyes and recited. "Many nights I dream beside open water, hearing the winds pass high. Many nights I lie by the snake's den and dream of Farula in summer heat. I see her baking spice bread on red-hot sheets of iron and braiding water rings into her hair. The amber fragrance of her bosom strikes my innermost senses. Though she torments and oppresses me, I would have her no other way. She is Farula, and she is my love. A storm wind rages through my heart. Behold the clear water of the Kanat, gentle and shimmering." Leet opened his eyes, as if emerging from a dream. "I've heard better," Warwick said. "I've written better. But you show promise. You might find a woman to accept you after all. But never Farula." Leet feigned offense. In silence, the two watched the Freeman children continue to capture sand trout.